Good morning and welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. I'm your host, Stone Payton, with the Desai Group, and I'm joined by my producer and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Mr. Stone. How are things? How was your weekend?
Oh, it was great. I want to know, though, do you notice anything different about me today? He has this puzzled look
taller.
On his face. Well, one of my smart aleck relatives slid some Grecian formulae into my stocking over the holidays, and so I tried my first dose this morning.
So you look grayer?
Probably. I don't know. I think it's supposed to work kind of slow, though.
Yes, dramatic difference.
All right. Well, so tell me, what'd you do this week?
This week, just football. It's playoff. This is serious business for me.
Yeah, well, it is at our house, too. Not for me, but my wife's a Gator, so she was just as high
as a
kite.
That's right. I'm a Gator, too.
Yeah, I know. Week. And I look past all of that.
Thanks.
No, we've had a really great week. Of course, we're neck deep in the Timmy Awards, the year's most innovative here for Atlanta. We've got nominations pouring in and really looking forward to having the party out at Rome, Atlanta. So I've been busy with that website and all of that.
Oh, so any innovative things happen?
Yeah, a lot of neat things are happening, and we have got a marvelous show for you this morning. Our first guest this morning is a gentleman by the name of Chris McKenzie. He's co-founder and CEO of an outfit called Fluid Innovation. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Stone.
You are more than welcome. Just to get us started, can you give us a little background on Fluid Innovation, how you guys got started, and what you're all about?
Sure, absolutely. Actually, back 2005, we started Fluid Innovation. Actually, before that, came out of SBC Communications. I was in corporate strategy for a while, and about 2002, a lot of large enterprises had started to do a little bit more strategic management of their intellectual property, building, you know, less legal-oriented IP shops. And that's what we did at SBC. We created an organization called SBC Knowledge Ventures, which was targeted at, you know, identifying internally developed technology, both patents, trademarks, and software know-how and sets of data, and looking for commercialization partners now outside the firm to license it and turn it into their own products. So did that for a few years, figured out kind of some of the, you know, trials and tribulations, and actually realized, you know, reading up on some of the innovation literature that, you know, Forrester's done a good job calling what they call innovation networks, that there was an opportunity to create essentially a service provider, kind of a broker in the middle, to help these larger enterprises identify some of that internally developed technology and commercialize it into third parties.
And so, I'm sorry, so how does that work? Do you have people coming to you, they've developed intellectual property, and they're saying, okay, we want to find a way to commercialize this, help us find the people, help us structure the deal?
Yeah, usually, I mean, we've done something in terms of focusing. I think what we found is if we're essentially creating a market, we feel that there's a lot of innovation that happens inside an organization, or we'll call it invention at that point. It's mm-hmm. not really innovation until it's, you know, commercially applied. But a lot of companies, American Express or Lockheed Martin, they're not in the software business, and we've focused exclusively on helping enterprises commercialize some of the $75 billion a year that they spend on internally developed software development.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is, can, you know, you solve a business problem at the Mayo Clinic, license it or sell it to, you know, Cerner or Mises or a startup for that matter, to take that technology. It usually needs to be fixed up. It needs to cross that kind of commercialization gap. We help identify the existing company that fits really well with their product roadmap and can license or acquire it and take it to market. It's a great strategy for most existing software companies, as opposed to traditional M&A or you know, internal development, both, you know, high cost, high risk. This they can typically be on a shared risk model with a royalty structure.
Can you share an example of a company you work with that you were able to commercialize a piece of their software?
Yeah, let me give you a one. We actually won a dual distinction award through the Licensing Executive Society for this one. Was a Lockheed Martin technology, actually out of their aeronautics division. And if you imagine, they build, you know, fighter jets, and they need to do repairs, and so they have what's called technical orders. And before, they used to have paper books, then they went to PDFs, but then you open up, they all reference each other. And so they ended up building a customized web browser for managing very technical documents. Built in a lot of neat features, and they were maintaining and supporting that internally. And there's a lot of their other customers in the government that could use the software, and so we ended up identifying a commercialization partner that licensed the technology, took out that internal development and support cost that Lockheed was incurring, and now has gone to market selling a commercial product, you know, customized browser to manage documentation around technical orders.
Are you getting any resistance, or did you early on, from organizations to this whole idea of commercializing their IP? Because my experience has been, of course, I'm not in the software arena, but my experience has been in other firms that really do hold their IP very dear and are sometimes a little bit reluctant to let it go. Has that been the case for you and your conversations at all?
That's one of the reasons that we've, you know, focused on software, which tends to be, you know, what I'll call a less, you know, core technology. You know, when you get to a patent or something that is very product related, it becomes more difficult. But we work with, you know, companies like Microsoft, you know, who has a $8 billion a year R&D lab related to computer science. And even them, they're not going to commercialize every single research project that they come out. And they've been, you know, working. I think what it is it's an evolutionary process. They're trying to work to change some of the culture. It's always been this kind of not invented here, this we'll call linear product development path, which, you know, we see breaking down. We think that the future is really around somebody come up with the idea and, you know, give it to somebody else to execute on. And so we're starting to see that breakdown.
Can you say more about a term that I saw a lot on your website and I heard in talking to some of your people and getting you booked on the show, and that's this idea of open innovation?
Yeah, it's. I mean, obviously, you know, Hank Chesbrough at Berkeley, you know, wrote the book and coined the term. You're starting to see a lot of other, like Forrester, but they basically call it the same thing called innovation networks. And it's taken on a little, I think, buzzword in and of itself. A lot of people will apply it to you know, kind of co-creation. Like I've got a, you know, Procter & Gamble, I've got a new product that I want to come out with, and I can work with my partners and suppliers. But really what open innovation, I think, is about is it encompasses the idea that you have a traditional linear process of R&D and development of new ideas, and you capture them. At some point, some of those ideas are not fit or ideal for your firm to commercialize or take to market. And so is there an opportunity to create an exhaust valve, take some of those ideas, put them into a marketplace, which is what, you know, Fluid does for software, and share them, reduce some of the search costs to get those into the hands of another third party that can execute on it. Where it comes into the play as well is if you get further down the line and you have gaps in a product roadmap, and you're looking for ways to fill those gaps. And so some of the ways are, you know, you find companies like Innocentiv or Nine Sigma that says, here's a problem that I have in my, it's a gap, can I, you know, use crowdsourcing to help fill the gap, or can I use co-creation with my partners or suppliers, or can I look at, did another company already solve the problem internally? And so it all kind of fits together in a big kind of ecosystem.
Now, when that kind of collaboration is taking place, how does it work when it's time to actually monetize it? How is the revenue shared?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question. I mean, that's in terms of if you actually do some of the direct, you know, co-creation.
Right.
Or even some of the collaborative kind of web stuff. there's a gentleman, I cannot remember his name right now, at the Penn State University that's doing a bunch of research around the legal aspects of that. Is how do you define ownership of the IP if it was done collaboratively and maybe by people that never even met each other?
Right.
So I think that's going to be evolved, and so that's why we've tended to, at least early on, focus on technology that was, pretty clear on who owned it. It was developed at American Express and their IT organization. And,
right. That seems very clean.
Yeah. So I think it's just a, exciting new kind of landscape. We think that's really what's going to drive, the economy innovation in the future. It's really going to be the economic stimulus because it involves, renewed investment and bringing in new products to market quicker.
Now, when you say that innovation is going to drive the economy, any part of innovation is, making mistakes. How do you, when you're communicating with C-level people in different organizations, how do you get them to understand that? That, we're going to take shots and they're not going to work,
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, the way we're, we're kind of looked at as kind of a broker, and so it's, we try to impart that it's a portfolio approach, right? Just like anything, whether it was kind of a venture fund or an acquisition, traditionally, if you're going to look at 10 technologies that you might want to commercialize, three, maybe four will actually transact, and of those three or four, one or two is going to fail, and, one's going to be okay, and one, will do well. And so that's really kind of the way we pitch it. So most of the C-level folks are familiar with the venture model, and so, you have to kind of overlay that in this case as well.
Are you finding that the landscape is changing at all with respect to when an organization like a Microsoft or an American Express begins to look at developing new IP in the software arena, that they develop it with the idea in mind that they will eventually venture it for external commercialization and that has an impact on the design?
That is funny you mentioned that. I mean, we've talked about that internally quite a bit in terms of if you it's a little bit of a chicken and egg, right? The more volume of deals that you can funnel through, that you can show that there's a market exists for the commercialization of this technology, the better off you'll be at starting to stimulate some of that behavior. And I think it's early in that. We're actually working on a big project with some of our clients and a lot of the service providers that'll launch in the second quarter that hopes to essentially aggregate some of the news. I mean, I think right now you look at it and all of the kind of deals that happen around there are, they happen. They just happen, between a couple parties, and there's not really an outlet for the, think of it, the tombstones that this, acquisition or this deal happened. So I think there needs to be an outlet for that.
Now, you've consciously, as an organization, it sounds like you individually have chosen to stay well within the parameters of the software arena, but do you really see some promise perhaps at some point outside of software for business disciplines or business processes that could be properly protected and then ventured for commercialization as well?
Absolutely. I think, we've also built, some, we think there's a particular process and you have to reduce the search costs. And so our approach was build some technology to support that process, which is something that we have called Fluid Licensing System. It helps kind of the capture, organize, screen, and work through the process of a deal. And we focused on software also because you have to make a market. You have to have kind of that, I'll call the inventory as well as the buying community. And at least in the software industry, there's about 4,400 vendors in kind of greater North America. About 1,200 make up, 80% of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can start to build relationships and incorporate them into the process. But as soon as you kind of validate the process and have a platform, you can obviously move it into, medical devices and consumer goods products or other types of IP and technology.
So are you practicing what you preach and commercializing that process?
Actually, we are. That's part of what we're doing, is embedding it into this more collaborative organization that will be launched in Q2. That'll essentially bring together a lot of our clients, so the enterprises, the transactors, in conjunction with the service providers. So we'll be essentially side by side with some of our competitors and other service providers in kind of the commercialization industry.
And you guys utilize or capitalize on several kinds of events to pull this off, get people together. What have you got coming up? Anything coming up in the near future that's supporting this kind of thing?
We actually have a nice webinar series. One of the first ones that we're working with some of our clients, I think it's the 21st or 22nd, confirmed with Microsoft as a co-presenter, just to talk about open innovation and the benefits that it can have to a software company, how it can tie into their product roadmap, especially in a difficult economy. And then we're speaking at a couple events throughout the year. I think SaaSCon in March is another event that we're getting out and talking to folks on.
Is your business evolved to the point where people are now just approaching you because they want this done, or are you still having to pursue them?
It has gotten to some point. What's interesting is we've focused mostly on, from a scale perspective, let's go to an enterprise where we can get multiple technologies, but now we're starting to see smaller companies, contact us with, hey, we've developed the technology. And I'll tell you, there's, one, we usually kind of didn't have be very responsive, but there was a company called Little Earth that has a website called Patent Surf. It's one of the most amazing kind of patent research sites that you can go to. We're helping them work on the UI and license it into some other folks, but it does a semantic-based search, so you can take a whole patent and find related documents, and it ties into wiki articles and case law. And so that's one that we've taken on that just kind of came to us.
Cool. Fun stuff. Well, and I wondered if it's, with the landscape changing like it is, if the two brilliant college grads in the garage cranking out code, if they don't they don't have a better shot at having a tremendous impact in this arena than they did even 5-10 years ago.
Oh, sorry, I missed that question.
Well, I was just suggesting or wondering, I'm picturing, Bill Gates and that crowd in their garage so many years ago trying to even get anyone to notice them. And now with open innovation and organizations like yours to broker these relationships, if now it's not easier if you have really good, commercially viable software to get noticed and get things to market.
Yeah, I mean, I think that being able to collaborate on, because most of the, technology, a lot of times it's a great idea and it's great technology, and sometimes it's not, it needs a little business boost. There's a little sales and marketing aspect. I think that's one thing that we've realized, whether it's an enterprise, whether it's, a small inventor, they often lack, some real basics around sales and marketing and discount the importance of, putting on a good story around what's the value proposition, what's the benefit to the end user, what does the deal structure look like. And so those are some of the things that we've, I think, working to standardize. Even as you take a technology commercialization opportunity and you share it with potential partners, is standardizing what that looks like and putting the right information that a commercialization partner can consistently scan and react to.
What a marvelous service. And so what's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you individually and or learn more about Fluent Innovation?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they can visit our website. It's fluidinnovation.com. There's no S on the end of Fluid Innovation. Or certainly feel free to send me an email. My email's Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at fluidinnovation.com. And then I think we have a phone number and information on our website as well.
Terrific. Well, listen, Chris, before we let you go, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show. We like to ask each guest if they would to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career and what they've learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Sure. I mean, I'll say the one thing that, you know, I think I've learned, especially as you kind of become an entrepreneur and you know, start to build team of people around you, is it's really important, especially in the innovation space, is to find positive people. You might look at, you know, people that have very, very good credentials, but their attitude, you know, is just negative. And when, I mean, it's hard to take something and turn it into something of value. And you just, there's a lot of ups and downs and a lot of, you know, probably more downs than ups. And you just need to surround yourself with positive people. And, you know, certainly made a few mistakes early on in you know, in kind of the people department. I guess that's my my advice, is especially if you're in the innovation space, you know, seek out, you know, maybe less qualified, but you need a positive attitude.
Hey, I could qualify for that job. I've got a great attitude. I don't know anything, but maybe that's
that'll
why I'm allowed
you
to play.
A long way, I think.
Well, thank you so much, Chris McKenzie with Fluid Innovation.
Appreciate it, Stone. Have a great week.
You too, man.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Lee, I heard the phone ring. Was that your girlfriend or was that our next guest?
Next guest, buddy. The party never ends over here.
Well, next up is John Enright. He was director of new business and marketing for Lime Exchange, which is a sister company to Lime Wire. And I think George has got a lot of neat stuff to talk to us about. And I don't have the first clue about how to articulate what this organization does. So why don't we just get him on the horn and start asking him about it? John, are you there?
Hi, Stone. How are you?
I am doing well, man. Forgive me for not remembering. Where are you calling in from?
I'm calling from sunny South Florida.
All right. What was the weather? The weather's better today in Atlanta. It's been raining like crazy up here. Is it raining?
Really? Yeah, we've had a fantastic winter so far. It's probably the best I've experienced since I've been down here. So it makes it hard to travel to other places throughout the country this time of year.
Is LimeWire based there also?
LimeWire's headquarters are in New York, where it is quite a bit colder. It's about, I think it's about 70 degrees colder there right now.
So you're always calling them, giving them a hard time and laughing at them, right?
Always rubbing it in their face, that's right.
Well, you know, the closest thing that I have to a boss is in Hartford, Connecticut, so I love calling them and asking them about the weather.
Oh, yeah.
It's fun to poke fun at them. Well, tell us
a little... They can turn it around on us, you know, in the summer, you know.
Right, right. Well, tell us a little bit about Lime Exchange. What is it? How does it work? What are you learning? Just fill us in a little bit.
Sure. Well, I guess the best way to describe Lime Exchange would be an eBay for services. You know, most people, when they think of buying and selling products on the Internet, they think of tangible goods, like a DVD player or a camera. And... the fact is that the Internet's also a great medium for exchanging services. So things like web design, translation services, copywriting, voiceovers, even video editing kind of lend themselves to being done remotely and therefore being done over the web. The problem, though, is that there are thousands of professionals in each one of those areas. How does a buyer find the right one for their job? And, you know, the other problem is... that it's services are more of a gray area. With the products, it's pretty black and white. You know, one person's Canon 5D is the same as any other person's Canon 5D. But with services, it's really in the eye of the beholder. So two different graphic designers can work on the same project and produce very different results. And really, that's where Lime Exchange comes in. Lime Exchange is an online services marketplace where service providers can go, create a profile of their... of themselves, upload a portfolio with samples of their work, client testimonials, and then buyers can go to the same marketplace and either choose a professional that meets their needs based on their portfolio, or they can post a project and have multiple providers bid on it.
And when a person does that, like, is there a rating system to vet the people? Or what's the objective? If you're, like, say I'm looking for a web designer, what's my best strategy to choose the best one?
Well, I'd say the first thing is take a look at their work. You know, each person can upload a profile and samples of their work. And with web design, you know, everyone's style in web design is slightly different, and each industry has a different style for kind of what's acceptable on the web or what's cutting edge on the web. And, you know, it's really about taking a look at the provider's background, you know, what other sites has he done, do those sites kind of meet your what you're looking for, your objectives. If you're trying to get a really complicated website up and running that's has a lot of functionality, has the provider done, you know, projects like that in the past? I think the most important thing is to really communicate with providers up front. You know, ask questions, you know, get their feedback on your project. And, you know, that accomplishes two things. One, you learn more about the provider's background. But two, you kind of get to test out whether or not they're going to be articulate and responsive. You know, if a provider isn't responsive to your questions before you actually engage them on a project, odds are they're not going to be much more responsive when you're actually working with them.
How do you differentiate your service as opposed to the other freelancing and outsourcing applications?
Well, we go beyond just being a directory of providers and actually help buyers and providers go through the entire project process. So once you select a provider, we have a whole variety of tools that help you establish milestones for your project, track the progress of your project, communicate. We have a whole interface where you can actually email or IM and communicate with a variety of ways with the professional that's doing work for you, and it's all archived. So if at any time during the project there is a dispute, you can kind of go back and there's a record of everything that you said and the provider said. So we kind of make it easy to, you know, because a lot of people who are buyers may not necessarily have experience in working remotely with somebody. So our interface kind of helps them along that process. And it kind of serves as a project management tool as well. And we recently introduced a feature we call proof of concept, where which is pretty innovative, where after providers bid on your project, and maybe you have four or five that look pretty good for the job, you can further narrow down the field by asking them to produce a sample of work, kind of a proof of concept or maybe a mock-up. If you're doing a website, maybe they would produce a mock-up of what the site might look like. And you pay each one of them a set amount. They can either participate or not, but then you really get a good idea of, hey, do these providers really kind of understand my project and what my ideas are for it.
What is the size of the typical this project that comes through your Lime Exchange?
That's about $1,000 on average. You know, websites are very typical, copywriting projects. The more elaborate projects, like programming, producing iPhone applications is really popular these days. Those tend to run a bit higher. But on average, it's about $1,000.
So how's this economy impacting freelancers these days? Is it having any different impact?
Yeah, you know, the impact is kind of twofold. One, there are a lot more folks here in the U.S. and globally that are looking for a supplemental form of income. A lot of folks are highly skilled and maybe in between jobs, and freelancing for them is a great way to earn some income and, you know, in some cases eventually become their own boss and have their own small business. And then on the flip side, there's also increased demand. A lot of companies are looking for more cost-effective and rapid ways to get projects done. And rather than, you know, maybe hire somebody internally to get a project done, especially if it's, you know, one-time project, more and more they're turning to freelancers to get things done. So there's more supply and there's more demand.
I know that last year, I guess it was last summer, I worked with a freelancer. I think the guy was like in Ireland to put my my book on audio. And so I sense and I see and I talk to a lot of small consulting firms, small business people that really try to take advantage of freelance opportunities. But are the big corporations, the Fortune 1000, turning to freelancers as a resource as well?
Sure. And, you know, there's a whole variety of types of providers out there. There's, you know, the individual, which is very common. But there are also firms that do freelance work, and these can have, you know, a number of employees, And especially with, you know, one-off projects, like an iPhone application is a good example. Even a relatively large company, if, you know, maybe they want to increase their visibility through some unique iPhone application that maybe lets customers, you know, interact with their service, they may only need to do that once. So they don't need to hire, you know, a whole team of folks that are maybe have that skill set. It's much more cost-effective for them, you know, even as a large company, to work with a third party.
What were some of the challenges that you faced in trying to get Lime Exchange off the ground? That had to be tough.
Yeah, the biggest one, you know, we've now been in business for about 7 months. And, you know, at first, the biggest challenge was the chicken or the egg, right? Because in any kind of marketplace or directory, you have the providers and you have clients. And, you know, it's how do you get providers to sign up when you don't yet have any, you know, buyers coming into the marketplace? And it's even harder to get buyers to come to the marketplace when there are no providers. What we did was really focused on the provider side. You know, the fact is it's just really impossible to get buyers to come to a marketplace that's empty. And for the providers, what we offered them as an incentive was, hey, you know, this isn't a chance to come in at the ground floor and really design a services marketplace that that really meets your needs. You know, what are, you have a chance to actually provide feedback to us and guide the entire development of the feature set. So if there's something you're looking for, something that would make your life easier, you know, we'll definitely incorporate that into our product. And that worked extremely well. And now, even just after about 7 months, we have a total of 12,000 unique users, 10,000 of which are providers, and about 5,000 of which are buyers. And that actually adds up to more than 12,000 because there's quite a few providers who are also buyers. They actually, there's a lot of activity in between providers for services.
How are you finding that pile of providers to, you know, ask them their opinion to join?
Well, there's you know, we actually have a large office in India, consisting of about 75 full-time employees, a great team of developers and product managers. And there's a massive community, obviously, in India of service providers. So we started there with some of the best-known providers in India, and then moved from there to other countries. And now we have a very even distribution of providers in the U.S. and India. And it's relatively easy to attract providers through, you know, Google ads and banner ads because, you know, they're always looking for more exposure to clients. And our service is free providers to register for.
Now, can you share with our listeners a little bit about when you are working with somebody in India or overseas, like what are the challenges, the unique challenges when they're dealing with them?
Yeah, the number one challenge is communication by far. So someone in India might be 10 time zones away, and, you know, so, you know, the distance becomes an issue. And then there's also language barriers. In India, obviously, the primary language is English, but there are other countries and, you know, varying degrees of how well people speak English. And even in projects that don't directly relate to language, it's always extremely important to be able to communicate effectively. On Lime Exchange, we help buyers kind of, you know, pick a provider that has the right amount of skill by providing English tests for free that all providers can take. And they get an English score at the end of it. And, you know, so for a buyer who really wants someone to need someone who's very articulate in English, they can find somebody. And for maybe for certain projects where, you know, a minimum amount of communication might be required, you know, they can go with people that have maybe less of a handle on English. But communication is by far the number one challenge. And the key to that is to over-communicate, you know, and also leverage all the tools that the Internet has to offer, instant messaging, email, web conferencing. You know, fortunately, you know, technology enables us to go globally, but it also helps us communicate globally as well.
So you have an English test. You don't have an Indian test, though, do you?
No, not yet. you know, that's interesting because, you know, currently a lot of the buyers for freelance projects are in the U.S., the U.K., Australia, English-speaking countries. But more and more, there's a lot of activity coming out of developing markets like India and China, especially as providers get projects that they're not completely able to handle on their own. They might get a project for a very elaborate website, and they can do the web design, but they can't do the programming. So they themselves will become an outsourcer. So, and you know, that's something we're taking a look at is, you know, we try to be as global as possible. And, you know, sometimes, yeah, you're exactly right, people may actually need a particular buyer may need proficiency in other languages as well.
All right. One last question I wanted to ask you before we wrap up, and it's really more geared around how you handle innovation internally at Lime Exchange. Can you describe what kind of processes, what kind of thinking patterns, what kind of disciplines that you guys as a group engage in for your own innovation?
Well, for us, it's all about the customer. And I think one of the most beneficial parts in our development cycle was when we actually went to market. Prior to actually getting customers in the system, and I think this is true for all businesses, you have a lot of assumptions on what people need, what type of features people are looking for, what type of customer you'll be dealing with. And it's only when you actually get to market and get customers on board that you really get the real feedback. You know, you get to see who your customers really are. Oftentimes, a lot of your assumptions might be maybe a little bit off. And then I think from that point onward, it's really letting the customer drive. The customer really is the product manager. And, you know, really listening to them, making sure that their feedback bubbles up to the absolute top of the list. And, you know, that really energized everybody on our team as well. You know, once there's a big difference between working on something that is in the development cycle and versus working on something that's live and you have customers there and you can see the activity and you get positive feedback and, you know, it's very rewarding, especially something that's a startup and growing very rapidly. It's also a huge motivator for folks.
Can you share a little bit about how LimeWire decided to get into this?
Well, there's an investor group called Lime Group, and they own a number of different properties. LimeWire is one. There's also a brokerage and a hedge fund a community development project. And this is one of their incubator projects. They have a number of others in the queue as well. So they're kind of that investment group is kind of a incubator of a number of different innovative products.
And Lime Exchange is based where again now?
South Florida.
Based in New York with LimeWire.
What's the best way to for people to contact you?
Well, the website is www.limeexchange.com, and that's lime like the fruit and exchange like currency exchange.
Okay.
Email address is john@limelabs.com. Lime like the fruit and labs like laboratory.com.
Great. Well, before we let you go, John, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show, as you may have heard from our earlier guest. We like to ask each guest to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career and what they learned from it. Can you do that for us?
Sure, absolutely. Well, back when I was first getting started with my career, I worked for a startup web services company. So it was back in like 95. And they were doing very well. They had an effective direct mail campaign that was producing a good ROI. They were doing about 10,000 units a quarter in this direct mail campaign. And I was in charge of the operational side of the business at that time, so keep making sure the servers were up and running and that we could answer the phone and things of that nature. Well, the owner decides that the campaign's working so well, he wants to take it from 10,000 a quarter to 2 million pieces a quarter. And at first, I was pretty hesitant because, you know, I was worried we'd kind of trip over ourselves and, you know, the servers might go down, customers would get a bad experience, wouldn't be able to answer the phone. So I was arguing, hey, well, maybe let's ramp this up over a longer period of time and kind of see if it works and, you know, grow a little bit more smoothly. And, well, it turns out that he was absolutely right. His response was, no, we're going for it. That's why we're here. That's our job, is to make sure that, you know, that we can handle the growth and we will rise to the occasion. And he was totally right. We ramped up the campaign. We were prepared for it. We knew we were going to get a lot more volume, and it was exciting. We got a lot more customers. Everyone had a lot more energy because things were growing, and it was a challenge. And you know, we did have a whole list of issues that we were faced with, but those were really good kind of issues. And the lesson I learned there, fortunately, very early on in my career, is never be afraid to succeed. And, you know, really always, once you're sure, you know, and you've measured, and you know what to expect, definitely don't be afraid to step on the accelerator. You'd be surprised at how much reserve energy you get when you're in a success situation.
What a great lesson for all of our listeners, and a marvelous way to articulate it. Well, John Enright, thank you so much for being on the show, and maybe you'll join us again sometime.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, until next week, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, and the entire Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.